How much has the world you grew up in changed since you were born? Well, Fintan O'Toole was born in a working-class suburb of South Dublin and puts the profound changes of the past couple generations in Ireland into focus with his book, and it's called We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Modern Ireland. Fintan has long been a popular columnist for the Irish Times and is often called Ireland's leading public intellectual for how he writes about the issues and the people of his country. Fintan joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves to share what it was like growing up in Ireland, an Ireland you'd hardly recognize today, in the 1960s. Fintan, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a real pleasure, Rick.
Now, your book really is kind of built upon the changes in your country since the year you were born, in 1958. So let's just say your earliest memories were from the 1960s. And when we go to Ireland, as so many Americans love to go to Ireland these days, we have a kind of a fun little exercise to imagine what Ireland was like back in the 1960s in a simpler time, you know, but we have a hard time really making that vivid. Can you help us? What was Ireland like in the 1960s?
So I think if you'd gone to Dublin, the capital city, which is where I grew up in the early 1960s, you probably would have been a bit taken aback by how, you know, dowdy and derelict some of it looked. You know, it's a sort of 18th century classical city, but it was pretty down at heel. Yeah. Economically, the place had been in a bad way for quite a long time. So you would have seen a lot of buildings that were...
Colored doors? You know how you paint the doors in Dublin now, different colors, a whole rainbow of colors.
There were certain places where that was still done.
Yeah.
But there were also a lot of those beautiful old Georgian houses, as they call them, you know, from that Georgian period, were sort of empty. And
then I
think towards the end of the 1960s, you know, as I was getting older, you would have begun to see a kind of revival of those sorts of things.
Also, when you talk about gray, the image of Ireland when I go through villages is pastel, delightful painted cottages and all the beautiful colors on the buildings. And I look at photographs and there was no paint at all.
Yes. You know, I think it was a bit of a gray place. Now, the upsides of that. So, I mean, if you were a visitor and you got a bit of money, you know, the food in Dublin would have been great and you could afford it. You know, you could eat very well.
Yeah.
And then if you went outside Dublin, you know, you went around the countryside. I mean, it was fantastic in one way, I would have thought, because there just weren't all that many people there. You know, you could really go anywhere. There was a real sense of the countryside. The rivers were very, very pure. I mean, it was a fantastic place for people who were interested in fishing, angling, you know, salmon. It was very unpolluted compared to a lot of America, a lot of Europe.
And like an extended family, I get a feeling if you saw somebody on the TV entertainment show one night, you could probably see him in a pub the next night.
Absolutely. I mean, there were only about 3 million people left, you know, when I was born. It was very intimate, very religious, very, very religious. I mean, it was really dominated by the Catholic Church. We spent a lot of our time in the church. You would have seen, oddly enough, even though the population was quite small, you would have seen lots of kids around, right? So because the baby boom in Ireland was happening much later than in the US, you know, beginning in the early 1960s, I suppose, you know, you begin to get a bit of prosperity coming in, a little bit of more people staying at home.
You got the change, like just threatening, and you've got the church having a grip on things.
Yeah.
You've got things going on in the United States, you know, you got the Summer of Love, the Vietnam War, you've got the assassinations of Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. I suppose that had ripples in Ireland for change, but the church and the status quo probably didn't want it. Was the TV, for example, a change maker?
Oh, yeah. So we had one TV station.
One.
We only got TV really at the start of the 1960s. And TV, Rick, was a huge influence, you know, because, as I said, we hadn't had it. And so we're experiencing this new technology for the first time. Albania had television before Ireland did, you know. They wanted to keep it out. The church wanted to keep it out as a bad influence. But they eventually did have it, you know, one national TV station kind of owned by the state. Most of the stuff on it, there were news programs and things like that, but Most of it was old American TV shows. So they just bought a big load of cowboy shows, American sitcoms, I Love Lucy.
But did you have like Troublemakers? We had the Smothers Brothers and we had All in the Family and TV that was willing to talk about divorce or...
No, we didn't have a lot of that stuff. No, we had all the sort of... We had the stuff that you guys probably would have watched in the 1950s, you know?
Okay, so you were a decade behind us then.
You know, it was... So it was all black and white TV and it was these... So we were kind of behind the curve with some of that. Now, beginning in the, you know, in the 1970s, people started putting up these giant aerials and they could get BBC to television from Britain.
Wow.
And that, of course, had a lot more racy programs, a lot more controversial programs. See, you have to remember just how dominant the church was, right?
Yeah.
So books were still censored. Movies were censored. The censor would just cut, you know, they would just chop bits out of movies. So we never had this idea that the movie had a kind of continuous narrative, you know, that there was a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know,
wow,
we watched these movies
that.
just kind of jumped all over the place. So we thought, oh, that's the way movies are, you know. So it's kind of, I mean, it had been much, much worse. Famously in Ireland, the censor had censored Casablanca, and it censored Casablanca to cut out all references to the fact that Rick and Elsa had an affair in Paris.
Oh my
goodness. So you couldn't understand Casablanca. You know, the whole, well, we'll always have piracy. What? You know? So, you know, they would do these kind of completely bizarre things to try to avoid mentions of sex.
So crude omissions with no interest in what kind of ripples that would have in the script. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Fintan O'Toole, and he chronicles the changes in Irish society since his birth in Dublin in 1958 in his book We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Modern Ireland. It's been called one of the best books of 2023 by the New York Times. Fintan is a visiting professor in Irish Letters at Princeton University in New Jersey. There's more about Fintan's work with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. So Fintan, I understand there was a very strict and conservative sort of chain of schools, Christian Brothers schools in Ireland, and you were a product of that?
I was indeed, yeah. I mean, they were pretty brutal, to be honest. You know, it was all male, of course.
Ruthless. That's a hard word to describe your educational upbringing.
Yeah. You know, it was very violent. You know, there was a lot of corporal punishment, as they call it. So you were hit for almost everything. And this would be in primary school, like when you were 8, 10 years old. I mean, you were beaten for if you couldn't spell a word or whatever.
I'm just curious, what kind of corporal punishment? Spanking or?
So they had what they called a leather, and it was a leather strap, a short leather strap, which was really, really thick. So it was about an inch thick. And so they would hit you with that on your open palm, mostly. And it really hurt. I can still feel the sting of it and the sound of it. You know, it was kind of terrifying. And then the really crazy guys would have big sticks and they'd just beat people with sticks. Hmm. And, you know, it was violent. It was anti-intellectual. Now, to be fair, and it's always the case, Rick, isn't it? You know, there's always good people. There's always nice, sweet people who are well motivated. So we all, you know, there were always some of these guys who were really decent and did their best under really difficult circumstances. Yeah.
How did they censor what you read? Because you're an intellectual now and all about, you know, being curious and open-minded. Did they work hard in what they let you? I mean, when you think back on the textbooks and the assigned reading, what was that like?
So what they tended to do was that, you know, the assigned readings were not modern, you know, but poetry, you would get up to, you know, William Butler Yeats and maybe one or two of the later Irish poets, because poetry was all right, you know, it wasn't going to be... wasn't going to be erotic usually. We didn't study, for example, James Joyce, right? So James Joyce, I think the greatest novelist of the 20th century, you know, revolutionizes the novel, revolutionizes literature, writes, of course, about the very city I was in. You know, he's obsessed with Dublin. Ulysses, his great work, is a kind of map of Dublin. Every detail of the city is in the book. And yet, you know, that was... discouraged. Joyce was seen as a disgrace. You know, he was a rebel against the church. He'd gone to Paris and, you know, he hadn't conformed. You know, so that kind of thing, the women writers, a lot of them were banned, like Edna O'Brien, these wonderful young women writers who were coming along. So there was still a lot of censorship of literature. This was easing now into the 1970s and 1980s, but a lot of it still being around. The funny thing was, though, that people got hold of these books. So, as you know, it was a very literary culture. People read voraciously. Yeah. So it was this kind of very weird mixture of censorship and attempts to control. But a lot of the attempts to control really failed. So my father, who had never even gone to high school, he'd left school when he was 13 years old, self-educated man, you know. But he read Ulysses. Now, Ulysses is not easy to read, right? You know, but he could read that book, and he took me around the city and he showed me the places in the book. And because he found it, in a way, easy because he knew the places, he knew the voices, he understood it. So in one way, it was a horrible place to grow up because it was all this censorship and this kind of puritanical attitude to literature. On the other, it was fantastic because you had these great writers who had written about the city, and people did get hold of the books and did read them and were proud of them, you know. And so I grew up with that mixture where in school you learned a lot of historical literature because that was regarded as being okay. They taught us a lot of Shakespeare, for example. They don't seem to realize that Shakespeare is filthy, but you know, if you really want to be, if you want filth, look at Shakespeare. But it was kind of old filth, so that was all right. But actually, you know, learning Shakespeare for me was one of the most wonderful things. I still adore all that work. And also then you had these Irish writers, these modern Irish writers, you know, whom you could find out if you really wanted. And I was lucky enough that, as I said, my parents were great readers, and my father, even though he wasn't well educated, read these books, had these books around the place. So I was able to imbibe all that.
And your family environment is probably very interested in your moral upbringing. Whose photographs, whose paintings are you going to find on the mantle or hanging in the kitchen?
Well, so you would have had religious pictures. So the Sacred Heart of Jesus, you know, was an image that was I remember it very much in the kitchen. The Pope, of course. But bizarrely, on the other side of the Sacred Heart of Jesus was John F. Kennedy. You know? Kennedy in Ireland was particularly because of his murder, which came very shortly after he'd made this historic visit to Ireland. He was kind of seen as almost like an Irish saint, you know, and so there was this kind of strange mixture of religious iconography, and Kennedy represented, I suppose, dreams of being modern, you know, of being part of the American world, which Irish people, I suppose, wanted.
Do you actually remember when he came? I think you were like 5 years old when he came.
What I remember most is the excitement of the adults. I suppose, you know, when you're that age, you watch your parents and the people, you know, the older people around you very, very closely, and you remember that. And I do remember the air of excitement. You know, this seemed like a wonderful moment for Ireland because it seemed like a sort of homecoming, you know.
Must have been exciting.
All this pain of emigration, you know, because we lost all our people over the generations, you know, so many went to America. And here was like that Irish America coming back to us, and coming back to us in a form which wasn't about pain and embarrassment and humiliation, but power, you know, the most powerful man in the world, glamorous in his 40s, good looking, you know, charismatic, all that stuff.
Fintan O'Toole is often referred to as Ireland's leading public intellectual for how he writes about its issues and people in his twice-weekly column for the Irish Times. Fintan's book is We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Modern Ireland. It chronicles how Irish society has changed since he was born in Dublin back in 1958. Fintan is also a visiting professor in Irish Letters at Princeton University in New Jersey, where he joins us from their studios. We have links to his work with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. And Fintan, in your book, you wrote that John F. Kennedy was like both a disguise and a mirror. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think he was a disguise in the sense that, of course, he was, you know, much, much more powerful and glamorous and attractive than we were. You know, he is a way of trying to project a version of ourselves that was much more to do with how we wanted to be rather than how we really were. But there was also a mirror because he said things, you know, which no Irish person would have said. So he said For example, you know, he said Ireland's main export is people. He didn't mean that as a mocking thing, because of course he was one of those exports, right? You know, he came from that export. He didn't mean it in any way insulting. But if you were Irish, you just thought, oh God, that's true. And it's a terrible truth, you know. Mm. So even in the way that he was sort of explaining about the history of the migration and placing himself within that, it was sort of also painful. You know, he was showing us a reality. That visit by Kennedy was very exciting, but it also had that edge of saying, if we want to aspire to be modern, if we want to aspire to not have to export our young people, we have to change.
And Ireland really has changed, you can say, since then.
Yeah, it's changed almost beyond recognition in some ways, Rick. But the good thing is that the change is largely positive. You know, people can stay in Ireland. There's very low unemployment. There's levels of prosperity that Irish people could not have imagined. You know, so all those kind of very positive, realistic, ordinary things have happened. But when I said change beyond recognition, there's some ways in which you can still very much recognize it as Ireland. You know, it still feels like a distinctive place, you know, a place that has its own story and its own culture and its own way of seeing the world. And that's sort of hopeful. You know, it means that you can change an awful lot and still have some sense of continuity in your sense of identity.
And reading through We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Modern Ireland, one thing you can take away is Ireland has come a long way in that one generation.
Absolutely. Absolutely it has, you know. And it's nice to be in a country where, by and large, and again, you know, all sorts of qualifications, but by and large, you can look at it and you can say, yeah, this place is better than it was. And it's better than it was because we made some good decisions, you know, and collectively and politicians, you know, we often, you know, not like get great pleasure out of knocking politicians, but some of them made very good decisions, some courageous decisions, and they've paid off in the long term, you know. And it's not now that we're by any means a perfect society, but it's that we now have, for the first time in our history, we have the resources to be able to actually fix the things that are wrong. You know?
And I think it's fair to say, when you look at it, that the Irish people have done that because they have organized, they have had embraced good governance, and they have worked together through their politics to make their island a better place and a more promising place for the young generation. Fintan O'Toole, thank you so much for joining us and shedding a light on a childhood in Ireland, way back in the 1960s.
It's been a great pleasure, Rick.
Fintan O'Toole tells us how he grew out his curly brown hair into an Irish afro as a school kid back in the 1970s. It's in an extra from today's interview. You can hear that and listen to his earlier conversations with us at ricksteves.com/radio. A tour guide from Northern Ireland explains what you can expect to find across the border in her quarter of Ireland. Tips for enjoying a week in Northern Ireland are just ahead. We're at 877-333-7425 or by email, it's radio@ricksteves.com.